today, on our third show, we are talking with a distinguished guest. Her name is Michelle Klimisch. Michelle Klimisch has been reading the book since 1974. At the age of 19, she found it. And she is the author of a book called The Story of Everything, which is kind of a Reader's Digest version, maybe, of the Urantia book. It explains the papers and paraphrases them in her own words. And we're going to talk to Michelle today about part two, because we just did part one last week with Chris Halverson, and today we're going to talk about part two. Michelle, welcome to The Cosmic Citizen.
Thank you, Andre. Hi, Paula.
Hi, Michelle. So good to have you on our show today, especially talking about part two. How wonderful is that?
Thank you, Paula.
Well
Michelle, let me begin by our part two is titled The Local Universe. So let's just do a basic Dick and Jane thing here, especially if we have any readers, people who are not readers listening. But even if we have readers listening, we can clarify. Oh, dear. I'm sorry. Another cell phone just rang in the background.
Is that the plenary
radio? Radio, folks. This is what happens.
Like an ice cream truck, Andre.
Okay, we got that. We got that taken care of. Okay, what I'd like to ask you, Michelle, is just to clarify for listeners, readers or non-readers alike, what is a local universe?
Good. Well, the Urantia book describes the structure of the universe of universes. And it starts with paradise at the core, surrounded by the central universe. And the central universe is in turn surrounded by seven super universes. A local universe is one of 100,000 units within each of those seven super universes. So each of the seven super universes are divided into 100,000 units. And those are called local universes. And it's almost, to me, this is a very interesting topic, the local universe, because it's about the midway point for us as mortals, starting as we do on the planet. We start on our planet, which our planet, obviously, called Urantia, is part of a system, which is part of a constellation, which makes up the local universe. So for us, the local universe is about the midway point between where we are born and where our destiny lies, paradise. So the local universe is really like a microcosm of everything else. It's about as big as we can probably put our minds around at this stage of our development.
You know, Michelle, I like to kind of, I remember trying to explain this to somebody once, that you know, I kind of was trying to compare, you know, our system is kind of like a city, a constellation is kind of like, or you know, system might be like a county,
mm-hmm.
constellation
mm-hmm.
is kind of like a state, local universe is like a nation maybe, you know.
Good.
I'm sorry?
Right, mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so I think that's a really easy way to kind of explain it to people in a way that, you know, an analogy they can understand. So they don't have to think cosmologically. They can just think, you know, from sort of a political point of view even, you know, because these are political jurisdictions we're talking about here. You know, they're administrative. So, you know, but you can think of the seven universes like the way you think of the seven continents here, although the central, you know, then you've got the central universe, obviously, in paradise. But anyway, so our local universe is called Nebadon, and let's get real basic again. Who is the sovereign of Nebadon?
Oh, Michael. But what's interesting is Nebadon itself, each local universe is defined by the presence of the mother spirit. The consort of the Michael Sun, the two rulers of the local universe, are a Michael Sun and a mother spirit. And the Michael Sun is the product of the Father, God the Father from paradise, and the Eternal Son, create this Michael Sun that's going to rule in the local universe. And his consort, the divine minister, or the mother spirit, as we call her, is created by the infinite spirit, the third source and center. So we have all aspects of deity combined in these two people that are running our local universe. And I think that one definition of the local universe is that area that's defined by the presence of the mother spirit. So each local universe has its own mother spirit and its own Michael Sun ruling.
So one of the things that I love the most about the Urantia book is the fact that it picks up on a pattern that is universal. We think it's unique, you know, in our circumscribed point of view on this planet, isolated in space. We think that what goes on down here is unique. Mother, father, child, truth, beauty, goodness, origin, history, destiny. The first three sources and centers we didn't really get into last week, but it's the Father, the Son, and the Infinite Spirit, the Son being the original creation, or you could say the Father, the Mother, and the Child, the thought, the word, the deed. And whatever pattern happens up there, as above, so below, we are a system within a system within a system within a system within a system, just as our very own bodies have systems, a cardiovascular system, a nervous system, a digestive system. These are all systems within the one system, and our being is a system within a larger system, and
mm-hmm.
that system is contained by a larger system, and that's a basic pattern. And when you look at it that way, it becomes so much more understandable that our local universe is a system within a larger system, and that system is governed like a family by a mother and a father. And which is what Michelle just pointed out, the father and the mother of our universe, Michael or Jesus, the same being, and the universe mother defines the space that we are actually contained in. We actually are in her. She is the spirit. So
mm-hmm.
I just love that aspect of the book, that it hones in on those patterns and takes them, you know, shows us how they come all the way down from paradise, from the center of all things.
And Paula, they describe the cooperation between that male and female deity, the energy, where they talking the, that Michael is independent of time, and the mother spirit being independent of space, she is everywhere. That together, when they're working together, they're independent of time and space. And together they've been able to create the local universe, create all the beings that administer the local universe, they sustain us, and they minister and serve us. And the beings that they create are just a vast number of children of the mother spirit that minister to us constantly.
Oh, I want to
talk about this.
Go ahead. Sorry, Michelle. I wanted to focus, Michelle, on so the book part two is about our local universe specifically,
mm-hmm.
and I'm very glad that we're talking about local universes in general and what they are, because each local universe has a Michael and a mother spirit. But let's. For those, again, who may not be familiar, Paula mentioned Michael and Jesus as being the same being. What is the significance of Michael for our particular local universe and for our particular planet? I mean, again, let's get real basic here. Why is that so special to us in particular on Urantia?
Are you speaking in the sense that if you've seen the Son, you've seen the Father, that for all intents and purposes, Michael is God to us in the local universe. He is, and we're going to pass through, and when we pass through Universe Headquarters, Jerusalem, you know, we literally must pass through Michael, which we know is Jesus on this planet. We had a very special, you know, experience with him on the planet that we're born on. But you cannot get to God without going through Michael. So every experience that we have at this point. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just want to reiterate for the listeners that Jesus and Michael are the same, that Michael is Jesus. Jesus. A lot of people don't know that Jesus' name is Michael. In the Bible, it calls it talks about Michael, the archangel, but really, we as Urantric readers know that that was a sort of a misunderstanding or a garbled thing, that really Jesus is Michael. And if you look at the word Michael in Hebrew, it means one who is like God.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, Andre, too, that Urantia book readers aren't the first to say that Jesus and Michael are the same beings. The Jehovah's Witnesses say it very commonly. They teach that Jesus and Michael are the same being.
They do, but they also believe that Jesus is Michael the Archangel. See, they have that confusion about his order of being. Although the Seventh-day Adventists recognize, I think, that Jesus is Michael, and that they still recognize Jesus Christ as God. So, I'm glad you mentioned, Paul, Michelle. I know we can get more into this when we do a show on part four, but I'm glad you mentioned, Michelle, that Jesus or Michael, if you want to call him that, you know, is God, because that's something that I get it's a particularly important issue to me as coming from a Christian background. Because if the Urantia book did not teach the deity of Jesus, I would not be reading it. I think what happens with a lot of people, with Christians and Urantia book readers included, they'll say, well, Jesus is not the second person in the Trinity, therefore he's not God. That's really not what the book teaches, though. Yes, it's true, he's not the second person in the Trinity, but he embodies the fullness of the Father and the Son. And as you said before, the Mother Spirit embodies the fullness of the third source and center. So we have all three aspects of deity. You know, we have a local representation, local universe equivalent of the Trinity right here.
True. And it's interesting, too, because they call it a conspiracy of spiritual forces working on our behalf. We have the Mother Spirit, who the Spirit as we sense it is called the Holy Spirit. And she also gives us the Spirit of Truth, which is, even though the Mother Spirit holds the Spirit of Truth within her, that is the Spirit of Michael. The Spirit of Truth is our experience of Jesus. Is when we experience the Spirit of Truth, we don't actually recognize the Spirit of Truth. We recognize Michael, the teachings of Michael, and the leadings of our Michael son, of Jesus. We have these adjutant mind spirits, there's all these other things, including our thought adjuster that you probably talked about last week or the week before, but this conspiracy of spiritual forces, including this entire battery of angels and celestial ministers that are constantly seeking to help us advance in our spiritual quest. So it's kind of a neat web of spiritual ministry that surrounds us in the local universe. Is very, I think of it as a bridge. It's a bridge from material reality to spirit reality, because we start out here on these planets of our origin, the nativity planets, as they say, very flesh and blood, very material. And by the time we get to the local universe headquarters, while we pass through this journey, we're going to become more and more spiritualized as that journey goes along. So it's, you know, it's interesting how they've set this training up for us.
Michelle, you touch on a very important point in part two, and I think that it's of paramount importance to every human being that lives on this planet, because it describes in great detail what happens to us after we die.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole ascending journey through this local universe. Do you want to touch on that for a minute?
See, that's a wonderful, wonderful story, because that was one of the things, like Andre said, I was 19 when I found the book, and that was one of the questions, like, what do you think happens when you die? You're in college, and you're kind of just, you know, chatting around with your friends, and no one knows. No one has gone and come back again, but the Urantia book really describes something that makes so much, absolutely so much sense, makes sense of this mystery in a way. What the Urantia book talks about is immediately upon our death, what happens to us is that we start off again in exactly the place that we left when we passed from the material world. That essentially a death is nothing more than an escape from the life in the flesh. And so we've been released, and even though our body has fallen away, we are reconstituted on what they call one of the mansion worlds. Now, around the system headquarters, what Andre calls the county seat, I would think, there are seven planets. They're called transition worlds. And around each one of those transition worlds are seven more worlds. So there's essentially 56 worlds that surround system headquarters. And these are devoted to the what they call deficiency ministry, things that we might have left off in our training on Earth, character development that we might not have acquired in the life in the flesh. So we start on mansion world number one, and we go to mansion world number two, and we go to mansion world number three, and each one is devoted to a different aspect of our social development or our intellectual development or our ethical development. And so they kind of, it's kind of a catch-up for people that were born on planets. Some of us might not be missing all the pieces, all the elements. There are ways, of course, to pick up character development here on this planet. But it's wonderful that they've acknowledged, in a sense, that we sort of start in the wild, wild west. We really start in a place where it's quite primitive. And they very carefully look out for everything that we might be deficient in and help us acquire those skills and those characteristics and qualities of personality that we're going to need to be successful spiritually going into the future.
In one place, they call them remedial training spheres.
Exactly, exactly.
I'm glad they use that word, because I sure need a lot of it. I mean, the thing is this, you know, it's funny, you guys, because I've been thinking of this a lot lately. I just think we need to be so patient with ourselves and so patient with other people, because we're barely above the animal level. You know, I think sometimes I talk to some readers, and you know, it's like they want to be finalists tomorrow, and they think they have to have perfect faith, and they have to have perfect this, and you know, and I just am thinking, man, you know how many trillions of years it's going to take for us to get to paradise? You know, we have so much to do, or so much growing to do. We're just babies right now. We're spiritual embryos. And I'm kind of getting off topic a little bit here, but I just was thinking about this, you know, because, you know, you're talking about Michelle, about all these different character development issues we have to go through. ethical, social, cultural, intellectual, all these things. And, you know, something like say, well, gee, haven't we figured all that out here? Well, obviously not. We're just beginning. And by the way, I want to make sure that I know the phone number's on your screen, listeners, but I want to make sure I give this out. If you want to call into our show and ask a question of our guest or of us, you can call in 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158. Another topic, you know, that's covered a lot in part two, Michelle, is the Lucifer Rebellion. Because that's something that you said was very important to you when you read it. What was the Lucifer Rebellion all about, and why did that have such a special resonance for you when you read it?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because in part two was the everyone has this thing, Andre. I shouldn't say everyone, but people say, you know, I was really drawn to the Urantia Papers because of this, the description of the apostles, or because of the story of Adam and Eve, or, you know, the biography of Jesus, which is just exemplary. You know, there's different parts of the book that different kind of the hooks. There's the book is so. That's why I called my mind the story of everything, my condensation. It covers every topic that a person could possibly be wondering about. And for me, when I found the book at the age of 19, I was really desperate to know these things, that God is good. And he didn't, my sense of it was I had no understanding of how the world operated, and that to me, reality was this planet. And I didn't understand the rules here, and I was miserable. I mean, I was probably suicidal. I was clinically depressed, I'm sure, and had been for a couple of years, and just thought, how could God, who's supposed to love us, dump me on this horrible planet where I don't understand how to operate, and people are so false to each other, and these bad things happen, and evil people have, you know, their way with others, and I just could not get a grasp on how a loving God could leave me, abandon me here, you know? And when I came across the Lucifer Rebellion paper and got the concept in my mind that maybe the universe is a good and friendly place, and maybe God had a plan for us that did not, somehow it went awry, somehow someone went astray, and then took us down into this place. And Andre, you've talked before maybe about the fall of man as describing Christianity, and I've often thought, C.S. Lewis talks about in one of his, I think it's in Mere Christianity, that he talks about us being in enemy-occupied territory. You know, he has a very clear vision that this planet is not the way it's supposed to be running. We're in the hands of the enemy, essentially, is how he puts it. And if I had read C.S. Lewis as a young person, anything but the Narnia Chronicles, I might have not needed the Lucifer Rebellion papers to help me sort this through. But it was the first time the idea that Lucifer defaulted, that this person who was in charge of our system, maybe I should back up and tell you the story of Lucifer, how it goes, but it was a revelation to me that maybe the universe is a good place and just our little section of it went wrong somehow. Because God put his faith in he has a system in place where he lets lower orders of beings run the show. And we learn a lot from having to be administrators. But out of the kind of, it's a Lanandadect sun, which is a mouthful, Lucifer's order of being, there are like 10,000 of them in the system, in the local universe systems. Only one of them, I'm sorry, I beg your pardon, three of them ever went astray in our local universe. Three out of 10,000. So it's a pretty, you know, it is a pretty good system. For the most part, it works very well. It just didn't work very well in our system.
It's a basic pattern, too, Michelle, I think.
Yeah.
It's really important to touch on that. As you descend from the center of all things where God lives in his paradise perfection, the farther you get away from that center, the greater the potential for things to go wrong. The closer you get to the center of perfection, the greater perfection is. But as you move out in time and space, farther away from that great central light, the darker it gets, and the more the potential for betrayal or imperfection, the kind of betrayal that Lucifer committed. And the Urantia book explains this in full, that as you move away from the center with these descending orders of beings, the potential for default and betrayal gets greater, and at the Lanandadect level, it pops up for the first time, and further down from that, it continues on. But as you get closer above that level, it doesn't happen at all. Mm-hmm. So you start to understand the potentials for these things to happen and their ramifications to us as little humans. It's like a kindergarten teacher who teaches these kindergartners the exact wrong things, the things that no parent would want kindergartners to be taught. That's what Lucifer did to us. Mm-hmm. And he betrayed God's trust. He betrayed the trust of Jesus, Michael. And he betrayed our trust. We were too young to even know what was happening to us. And we were thrown headlong into a horrible rebellion. And, you know, we've suffered the consequences ever since. But the beautiful thing about it, and what you've touched on, I think, that is so important to me, too, is the fact that knowing what happened allows us to forgive ourselves for being a bit retarded.
Going back to what Andre said earlier, you know, that we're struggling with so much, not only our own human imperfections, but the fact that we've been led astray in this, what they call the false liberty, and that we confuse license with liberty. And, you know, that was one of the things that came out of the Lucifer Rebellion, that his manifesto essentially said, you know, God the Father is a myth, and the Ancients of Days who run the super universes are foreign potentates, is how he described them, I think. And that he thought the mortal ascension plan was a waste of time, a waste of resources. We should be free and do as we please, is what he thought, you know, was his. And you really, someone in our small state of development, our primitive state of development, can't be allowed to run amok, because you see what happens when we're allowed to.
Have to have trust, especially where innocence is involved, especially where children are involved, and we truly are embryonic, just the children of the universe of universes. We're very small and precious to our Creator, and our Creator has to trust somebody to guide us and care for us.
And they have to be able to draw close enough. They, you know, as you said, the descending suns, and you get to this certain level, and you're so close to humans, you're so close to the lowest level, there is going to be some fragment of error. There's going to be some margin of error there. And we just have to
look into it. Michelle, one of the things Paul said is that, you know, the farther away we get from the center of the universe and from perfection, the more the potential there is for sin, for rebellion. And that brings me to a couple of interesting points. One is that in the Bible, it says that Satan or Lucifer, now we know from the Arantia book that Satan and Lucifer are two separate beings.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Bible, you know, they're looked at as the same. And it says that Lucifer was perfect. Well, there's no possible way that he could have been perfect. If he was perfect, he would not have done what he did. He would not have rebelled. So this whole expanded cosmology we get in the Arantia book clarifies this for me a lot further. It makes a lot more sense to me. But the other thing that's really interesting is, you know, why, I think some people would argue, why would God delegate this kind of, you know, power to imperfect beings? And I guess to me that's one of the things that's so beautiful about God. I've come to the conclusion, Michelle and Paul, that the most important thing in the universe, even more important than love, is freedom. And that freedom is the most important thing to God, and that God wants to give his imperfect creatures free will. And it's so important for him to get to that we have free will, that we choose him freely, that he's even willing to risk the possibility of rebellion and the possibility, you know, and he, you know, knowing that they're going to make mistakes, knowing that they're going to cause suffering, because freedom is the most important thing. It's kind of like there's an analogy that a writer that I know of, Dinesh D'Souza, makes about Saudi Arabia, and he says, you know, in Saudi Arabia, the women there aren't really modest or virtuous because they're forced to be modest or virtuous. They're forced to wear veils. They're forced to, free will is the only way that we can truly, I guess you could say, give God glory or truly become the people God calls us to be. Because if we're forced into it, it's never going to happen. But those are just kind of some thoughts I have about.
That's an excellent point, though, because they talk about free will, that free will is not just some imaginary concept. Free will is an actuality, and people get mixed up what that means. Because otherwise, what does God have? He's got a bunch of robots doing his bidding. What good is that to God? You know, God is love. God needs us to freely choose right. And the only way that that can happen is for the possibility of error to be, you know, there. When they talk about free will, too, I think people get a little bit mixed up, because free will doesn't mean I'm a human being, but I would rather be a fence post, or I'm a human being and I'd rather, you know, be a whale. I can't choose to be other than what I am, but I can choose to wholeheartedly give what I am to the glory of God and to the good of others and to the service of the universe.
And that is
I can choose not to. I can choose to say I don't want any part of God's plan. That is where my free will lies. I can choose not to go with God, and or I could choose to go with God.
That is about motivation. What you guys just said is about what motivates us. Are we motivated to do right because we love right, because we love doing right, and we understand that doing right is the best way to do it, that choosing God's way is the best way, or do we do right because we're afraid that God's going to get us if we don't do right? But we have a caller, you guys. Let's see what he has to say. 816, welcome to Cosmic Citizen. Hello? Area code 816, are you there?
Oh, we lost our caller.
Doggone it. So, yeah, I think that's the key point is, you know, what is our motivation? We grow because we're motivated to do the right thing because God has sent us this incredible being in the person of Jesus who descended from paradise to live a life as a human being. Our good friend Errol Strider says, Jesus makes the hand of God small enough to grasp.
Mm-hmm.
It's like God downstepped himself all the way to the human level just so he could hold our hand and hear us when we cry and comfort us, hear what we have to say and know our longings and know us in a very real and personal way. God does go out in search of the lost sheep. God is willing to go all the way. Are we willing to meet God by our own free will to choose to do the best we can to be like God? You know, that's our choice, I think, Michelle. And I, you know,
And you know what? When you speak like that, it reminds me of this. One of the things that had come out of the Lucifer Rebellion is that when you start saying that, you know, there were some lower orders of beings that can go astray, and certainly in our system rebellion, a lot of the lower orders were lost. But what they do say is that not a single ascendant mortal who had made it to Jerusalem, to Jerusalem, not a single person who started as a native of the, you know, worlds, who passed through their system training and passed through the constellation training and made it to the local universe headquarters was lost. Every single ascendant mortal stayed faithful and loyal. And it goes to kind of what Andre was saying, do you choose? You know, this kind of idea of free will, why would God delegate? Why would God allow these errors to be? And it's because when we live in a world where error is possible, we see it firsthand. We'll never make that mistake. We know where that path leads. We've seen it happen right before our eyes. Where these perfect beings, or these ones that were started out as imperfection and kind of came down a little, look, descendant sons, maybe, how can you say it? They've always been perfect. They don't know how bad it could be if you say God is a myth and we don't need to waste our time training these mortals. And we should all be free and have liberty and do as we want. But liberty divorced from service is just what they call bondage. I think they call it abject bondage, actually, if you're just allowed to do anything without the mitigating factors of loving each other, serving each other, those aspects where we all are working on this reality together and taking each other into consideration. You know, I wanted to touch a little bit about, in the local universe, there's these huge descriptions of celestial ministers and how the Mother Spirit has created all these beings that kind of help us as human beings and lower orders to sort of grow or learn. And listen to this list of things that they're trying to teach us, these angels are trying to help us learn. Patience, courage, loyalty, morals, teamwork. They want to help us to accept uncertainty. I think that's so huge for us. To let pressure develop stability, to be faithful, earnest, and cheerful, to accept challenges without complaint. And it goes on and on like this. How about, remember that famous one for Rio Rancho Book Readers about feasting upon uncertainty and fattening upon disappointment? They really are working on our character development. And these are some kind of spiritual, it helps us in our spiritual advancement to be cognizant constantly of how we relate to each other, and that's one of the things that the angels are working on with us all the time. And try to imagine what kind of being is created, what kind of creature is going to come out of being born on this low place where we are, the lowest point in the universe, really. We're the lowest form of intelligent life, apparently, that has ascendant capacity. But in the end, we're going to become these perfected beings who are moral and ethical and cheerful and trusting and faithful and merciful, and that our greatest joy will be worship, and we will be irrevocably enlisted in the service of God, forever immune to any rebellion. How valuable would that be to God? To have such a number of such people in his pocket, so to speak.
Invaluable, I would think. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say, Michelle, that here we are in this universe, and we have a mother of the universe, which is the universe, and we have the father of the universe, which is Jesus, and he descended to show us the way. Because where he came from is where we're going. His origin is our destiny. But what would you say is Jesus and the Heavenly Mother's job in the universe of in this universe for us? What's their job?
You know, they say they have three functions, really. And the first was to create the local universe to begin with. I mean, the power directors come in and sort of slow energies down to make it matter, but it's Michael and the Mother Spirit together that they create the local universe and the administrators of the local universe. And their next thing is to sustain and uphold us and uphold the local universe and keep life running and keep the systems going. And the third is to minister or to serve us. And the whole task for me seems to be, and it's enormous, it's what you said earlier about kindergarten teacher. You're taking someone who doesn't know anything about spiritual reality, and slowly but surely bringing them along step by step by step through until they're standing and they are actual spirit beings when they leave the local universe. And what an enormous task that is. It goes back to kind of what Andre was saying earlier. You know, he feels like we need to be a little more patient with ourselves, and the Urantia Book even says, you know, don't be discouraged when you discover that you're human. And every month that happens to me, maybe. But, you know, you're like, oh, why am I learning this again? Didn't I learn this already? But, you know, sometimes I do feel impatient that my progress is so slow. But really, we have to say, here we are, trapped in a meat body with all the animal tendencies that come from, you know, life on an evolutionary planet. And they're going to take this carcass of me and turn me into a spirit being who is moral and ethical and cheerful and faithful and trustworthy? That's a task.
Michelle, I want to ask you one thing I'd like to turn to, because there are lots of things that are discussed in part two, but they're also discussed in part three. So I don't want to. There are things, for example, on planetary princes, planetary atoms, planetary moral epochs. But I want to. Most of that stuff I want to wait until we do part three to talk about our own specific planet. But let me ask you this. There's a paper in part two on the inhabited worlds. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about that, because, you know, the Urantia Book, unlike a lot of other religious traditions, talks about the fact that, you know, the universe is teeming with life, that the universe was made to be inhabited. Let's talk a little bit about some of those other inhabited worlds. What are they like? How are they different from us? How are they the same?
Michelle, before we launch into that, can we take a caller?
Certainly, certainly. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Let's come back to that.
Hello?
Caller 720, you're on Cosmic Citizen.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I wanted Michelle to discuss, some people think about the wrath of God and that God is a jealous God. I'd like for her to expound on that a little bit, about how people think that God is, this nature of a wrathful, jealous God that, you know, wants to punish humans for their wrongdoing.
Mm.
Can she maybe expound on that a little bit?
And that's isn't that a common perception in our society?
Yeah,
you know, the Urantia Book has a beautiful way of saying that God, in fact, it kind of backtracks itself. It says God loves the sinner, but hates the sin. But in fact, God cannot even hate sin, because to God, sin does not exist. God can only relate to reality, and only things that are good are real. It's almost as if, the best way I know how to describe it is that evil is not the opposite of good. Evil is the absence of good. And God does not relate to absences. It's the same as a heat is not the opposite of cold, but cold is the absence of heat. It's the absence of heat. And evil is the absence of good. So in the true picture, God himself only relates to reality. That's what he's all about. He is real, he is good, he is love, and anything that does not encompass reality, good, love, truth, beauty, he actually has no reaction to it. It's as if it doesn't exist.
Can I stop you for a second, Michelle, because I want to clarify a little bit. I want to clarify for a minute. I don't mean to.
Go ahead.
The passage you're talking about is in part one, and it says that God cannot relate to sin because sin is not a person. God relates only to persons can only love and hate other persons. So God's love loves the sinner, but his justice destroys the sin. But God's justice is impersonal. It's like we reap what we sow kind of thing. God doesn't have this wrathful side that needs to punish sin. Sin is dealt with by universal laws like gravity. You jump out the window, you're going to break your legs. In the same way, if we sin, we're going to reap the consequences of that. If you embrace sin purposely and consistently, you are rejecting reality. So that's not a punishment to God. Mm-hmm. That's simply a consequence.
It's a consequence.
That's right.
That's what they say, that iniquity carries the seeds of its own destruction. It self destructs itself. It doesn't need any help from God to do that. You bring up an interesting point though, Andre, because in the first part, which we're not talking about today, but that was one of the first times when I realized, here you're talking about God, the aspects of deity that are personal, and there are impersonal aspects. There's paradise and nether paradise, and so that's a whole other topic. But, that it's interesting that if he only relates to persons, that sin doesn't exist in
him. And by the way, that concept of evil being the absence of good also comes from St. Augustine, who said the same thing. In Latin, it's called the privatio bone. It means that evil is the privation of the good. It's not an equal presence like good. It's the absence of good. So that's a great point you're making. I'm trying to remember now what we were talking about before we had our caller, and I appreciate calling in, by the way, and asking us. If you could talk a little bit more about the wrath of God, though, because I know the caller was asking about that. So
can I share a quote about the wrath of God? Personal. It's from section 5 of the paper. Hold on, I'll tell you what paper it is real quick here. It's page 60 of the original book. And so it's early on in the book, early on in the first part, the very first section, and it makes this bold statement about the wrath of God, which just hits me right where I live. It says, "The barbarous idea of appeasing an angry God, of propitiating an offended Lord, of winning the favor of deity through sacrifices and penance, and even by the shedding of blood, represents a religion wholly puerile and primitive, a philosophy unworthy of an enlightened age of science and truth. Such beliefs are utterly repulsive to the celestial beings and the divine rulers who serve and reign in the universes. It is an affront to God to believe, hold, or teach that innocent blood must be shed in order to win his favor or divert his fictitious divine wrath."
Oh, that is so powerful. Paula, that was one of the concepts that got me attached to the Urantia book, because I had already decided that if the God was the kind, I was raised Roman Catholic, we all burn in hell. If you happen to die before you got to confession with a sin on your soul, we're going to burn in hell, or at least purgatory. And I thought, a God who would want to burn children in hell is not the kind of God I would like, to worship. And so that exact passage that you just read to us is one of those ones where I was just in my book, it's like right on with exclamations next to it. You know, that's it's just so true and so opposite of the upbringing that I had as a young person in the Roman Catholic faith.
The sound was like that.
So powerful.
How can we worship a God who is wrathful and vengeful? And, you know, God, another quote that I absolutely love says simply, God the Father transcends God the Judge. And so, you know, it's as Andre said, justice is a part of universal law. If you cut yourself off, if you are a branch on a vine and you cut yourself off from the vine, you won't.
You're going to wither.
Yeah, you will wither. You won't continue to survive because you've cut yourself off from the source that sustains you. But God does not choose to cut you off. You choose to cut yourself off. It's by your own acts that you punish yourself. God doesn't have to punish you. He doesn't have to punish me. We punish ourselves by cutting ourselves off from truth, beauty, and goodness, by cutting ourselves off from everything that he represents.
It's real, yeah.
Yeah, everything that's real, exactly.
I want to just make sure we get back to our topic.
The inhabited worlds, Andre. That's where you were going with us before the call.
Tell us a little bit about the inhabited worlds. How are the creatures that live on the inhabited world? How are they like us? How are they
different? Let's talk about that. Yeah, because that's a fascinating thing. Like you said, in this section, part two, they talk about the local universe entirely. The next section is going to go more into specifics about our planet. But all planets are not exactly like us, but they do have some similarities. The system itself has a capacity for 1,000 planets because we're in a fairly young system, Satania. We're not complete yet, so we only have 600 and something. I think it's 619 at last count. 36 more of those planets are closing in on the life endowment stage. So evolution is the technique that they use to bring life to a planet. What we have a description in about the life carriers who have developed 7 different physical types of mortals. And so we fall into each of these little categories in a different way. There's different atmospheric types. So there's some people who are non-breathers. They are living on a planet that doesn't have, you know, air as we know it. Sub-breathers, mid-breathers, super-breathers. Depending on what the atmosphere is, they have different kind of apparently lungs or whatnot. They said in our local universe, less than 3% of all the planets are inhabited by non-breathers, and that there is such a planet in close proximity to Earth. And this is always funny to us because what do they mean by close? When they're talking about very soon, within 2 million years, there'll be a couple hundred more planets. You know, their idea of how very soon is such a long period of time. What do they mean by very close? But there is a non-breathing planet somewhere near Earth, according to the reckoning of the revelators. Then there's different types of elements. Some people live in the land. Some people live in trees. Some people live in the water. Some people live in the air. And you've got to wonder, does that mean they fly? Does that mean they swim? You know, when we talk about mer people, is that sort of a thing from our past that, you know, just might be something that had come up from stories from other planets or whatnot? There's different gravity types, and their gravities are modified. The gravity pull of each planet might be heavier or lighter. So people in our local universe, we're supposedly 7 feet tall is the average height of human mortals. But the range goes from 2.5 feet, which I assume is a planet with fairly steep gravity pull, to 10 feet tall, which would be, you would think they'd have a lighter. I'm not sure. I mean, do you have an opinion about that? Is a lighter planet the shorter people, or it seemed like a dense planet would have shorter people to me.
Yeah.
Because wouldn't it be a strain on your system to have a tall body on a planet that had huge gravity pull?
Mm-hmm.
So we're about the middle of the range there. There's different temperature types, and it just depends on how you acclimate to, you know, different temperatures. There's 5 different types of mortals according to whether you're a mid-temperature or a high-temperature or a low-temperature. There's different mortals. Life carriers have developed different electric types, 10 different electric types. So how we adjust ourselves to the magnetic and electronic energies of our planet. So they have to create special types for that. What kind of food you eat, the nutritional types, they call them the energizing types, I think. And then there's other unrevealed, they're always having those unrevealed things, but they're called additional unrevealed variations. So there's different, there's other things that they just don't even go into. But they do say there are some similarities. One is that all will creatures are erect bipeds.
With so opposable
they
thumb.
They walk on two legs, and they stand tall. And there always are three primary and three secondary races, but not always on every planet. So the three primary races and the three secondary races that we saw on our planet don't always appear on every planet. The average mortal in the local universe has 12 physical senses. And we, by our reckoning, we have 5. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, but the
books
have 7.
Yeah, because we don't recognize everything that there is to be recognized. But so I've always been curious about that, because what other physical senses might I like to have if I was a life carrier and I was going to give myself some? That's a fun thing to meditate on.
I wanted to bring up something, Michelle. You mentioned kind of off topic, but I had to bring it up because you mentioned this. It's so interesting to me. You mentioned that the name of our system is Satania. That used to always freak me out. I was like, why would they name our system after Satan? You know, and I know that they named Dalmatia after Dalagastia. But, you know, I was talking to Chris Halverson about this. He's done some study of the etymology of the book. Mm-hmm. He made a very interesting point, which was that if you look at the word Satan in Hebrew, it means adversary. Okay, and
wow.
So and yeah, the suffix ia is a suffix for place.
Place.
Oh, actually, T-I-A.
T-I-A.
Place.
Mm-hmm.
But I-A in this particular case is also means place. So anyway, so he said what it means is place of adversity. And I was like, wow, that just makes so much more sense. You know, then now that doesn't bother me anymore at all.
Wow.
You know,
I love that you said that because that's very interesting. It's easier to take, isn't it? It's easier to take. I have someone, we talk about names, and someone said to me, why doesn't our mother spirit have a name? We know what Michael's name is. What is the mother spirit's name? So she decided it was Nebadonia.
I love that.
Because she defines the local universe of Nebadon, so she must be Nebadonia. Or Nebadonette or something, I don't know.
Since we're talking about different planets, let me ask you this. The book also talks in part 2 about something that a lot of readers love to talk about, because I think we're going to be there tomorrow. It's called Light and Life. And what is that? What does Light and Life mean?
They talk about Light and Life is one of the 7 on an average planet, on a normal world, let's say, they go through 7 epochs of life, of human life. And it's the paper is called Planetary Mortal Epochs. So first you have this very primitive world, pre-planetary prince, before there's been any bestowals. And these are, cliff dwellers and cave dwellers and, very primitive folk. Then the planetary prince comes, and they start sort of organizing family life and domestication of animals and cultivating the soil and that sort of thing. Then the Adam and Eve comes, the material son and daughter. So there's another era or epoch when the Adam and Eves come. And that's something you're going to hear about, I'm sure, in part 3 when you're really getting into our planet. They go deep into that one. And they sort of, that's when the blending of the races happen and the nationalism kind of wanes, the brotherhood of man, art, music, literature flourish. Then you have this, once you get into this worldwide peace, which is the result of the Adam and Eve bestowal, you get a magisterial son, which is it's a descending son who incarnates and rules for many generations. And generally, they really start fine-tuning the economy. This is the part where they say people only work for 2.5 hours a day on average, and they spend the rest of the time for the betterment of society. Wouldn't that be dreamy? And a lot of art and music, again, and higher learning. Then worldwide spiritual enlightenment, not just peace now, but worldwide spiritual enlightenment brings about the arrival of a bestowal son. And the bestowal son comes, and the main pursuit of the world now is moral culture, spiritual truth, that passion for spiritual reality, essentially. So new system of educations arise, new systems of government arise, and the military passes away, and they still have nations, they still have national borders and whatnot, but there's only one race, there's one language, there's one religion, and people live an average, in this era, 300 years is the average lifespan. Then a teacher son comes, and essentially the function of a teacher son is to come down to a planet that has really devoted itself to spiritual reality and bring in the era of light and life. And the era of light and life, we are told, if we were suddenly transported to a world that was in this stage, seventh stage of planetary life, we would think we were in heaven. We would be so blown away by the difference, even though it's mortals on an evolutionary world created this planetary culture. The culture is so different from our own that we would assume we were already in heaven. And isn't that a cool thing? And they say most people at this, they don't die physical death anymore. They fuse with their adjuster in the life, in the mortal lifetime. So they don't necessarily have, death is not the only technique we have to leave the planet, let's put it that way. And they go deep into that more, I think, in the next section of the book.
You know, it's so important, I think, too, to touch on, because you're touching on the seven mortal epics of evolution,
mm-hmm.
Nick.
Mm-hmm.
Each epic is characterized by certain achievements on any normal inhabited world. And when you read that paper, the planetary mortal epics, you get a real insight about how life evolves and civilization evolves and culture and in a normal way on a normal planet. And you also get a real good handle on where we're out of step,
mm-hmm.
which I think is an invaluable insight for all of us, and it gives us very practical then corrective measures to try to get back to where we want to be evolving, towards light and life, which is our goal as a planet. It even gives us a goal as a planet. I don't think any other religious text has ever given us a goal as human beings to say, reach for this. This is achievable.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it. You have to strive towards it, and it will take many generations, but it can be done, and this is where you're going. You're going from here to here. And I just find that whole paper to be so insightful and just so rich.
It's true, and you know, Paula, we can't, there's not a lot we can do about planetary, but we can use that as a template for our own personal developments, kind of getting a sense of what is our next step, what do we need to do. You know, the one thing that we have control of is our own development, our own behavior, but you know what's interesting is when you read a normal planet's development, those stages, those epics that they just described, and try to guess where Urantia is, where our planet is so spotty, you know, like we're a little further along on this one, but we're way back retarded on this one. So they must just be scratching their head what to do with us next. I mean, there's so many things that need to be done here. And, it's hard to guess what they really have their work cut out for them with us, I'd say.
And each one of those epics is characterized by an epical revelation, which the Urantia book claims to be the fifth that has been given to our planet. And I think that's an important distinction so people understand that in one epic of time, which could be 1,000 years or it could be 100,000 years, it just
mm-hmm.
depends on the rate at which a planet develops. In one epic of time, a world is given an epical revelation, and the Urantia book says, we have had five, it claims to be the fifth.
Mm-hmm.
And it says that Jesus was the fourth, Melchizedek was the third, Adam and Eve. And then, of course, the planetary prince who threw our world into darkness and rebellion was the first epical revelation. So we've been down from the get-go, in a sense, but the Urantia book does not make us feel hopeless, not by any stretch.
We've been down from the get-go. I love that phrase. It's true.
You know, I want to go back to something you're talking about, the Lucifer Rebellion. And by the way, I want to just get on. How much time do we have left, Paula?
We have 1 hour and 4 minutes.
Sorry?
It's five minutes to ten.
Up with 2 hours, so if we run over, we don't have to quit streaming.
Yeah. I need to go. Unfortunately, though, when the hour is up, I'm in a place.
So another 5 minutes or so. Can I say one thing before we jump back to Lucifer? What Paula just said, I want to respond to, because if the Urantia book is indeed the fifth epical revelation, as it purports to be, that means the fifth epic is normally the post bestowal sun epic, and this is an era that is characterized by moral culture, spiritual truth, spiritual reality, and thought adjusters arrive en masse to indwell all normal-minded people. And, of course, that happened to us after Pentecost. And the laws become less restrictive. The military passes away. You know, these are the kind of things. And you can see there is some longing in the people of this earth to have the military pass away, to have harmony among nations. So you can kind of, we get a sense that there is some correlation between a normal epic in a world of a normal world and ours, but it's for us to get a book instead of a bestowal son. How unusual is that?
You know what Mo says about that, Michelle? Mo says that the reason that they sent us a book this time was after they saw what we did, they couldn't get any volunteers.
Kill it. They can't kill one. They can't kill a book.
That's
really
true. Thanks for answering it, Paula. I was going to say, going back to Lucifer Rebellion, though, I think it's interesting because we're talking about other inhabited worlds. One of the worlds, Panopsia, is one that they call. That's a world where they chose not to follow Lucifer, and I guess that there was a woman on that world. I think her name was Eleonora, who took control and said, "Hey, we're not going to go. We're not going to follow Lucifer." I think it's very interesting. It reminds me of something interesting. There was a, I don't know if you guys are familiar with, there's a trilogy by C.S. Lewis called the Space Trilogy, and the second book in the trilogy is called Perelandra. And in that book, that's exactly what happens. You know, the serpent, in a sense, you know, tempts Eve, if you want to call it, you know, in the Eve character in the book. And she refuses to, somebody comes here from Earth. And
she thinks he's silly. Yeah.
Okay.
She doesn't fall for it at all. She thinks it's silly, the serpent, actually.
Right. And it's just very interesting. I've often wondered if C.S. Lewis had some sort of supernatural experience or something, because he talks about quarantine planets and things like that. But anyway, I just thought it was an interesting point to bring up, that, you know, that this rebellion was not just confined to our planet. It covered 37, I think, worlds in the local system. But, and if there were
37 worlds fell.
Yeah, and if there were worlds that chose not to rebel.
But you know what they say, Andre? We here in this isolated planet have a unique opportunity, a completely unique opportunity to, how can you say it? It's our faith development that you can't get if everything has been given to you. We who come through this kind of thing are going to be so strong in the faith that we have when we finally see all the things that we could have seen earlier, but, you know, our planet went into default. We have a unique opportunity. And I used to, you know, at the beginning of the show we talked about, I came to the Urantia book thinking, what am I dumped on this horrible planet for? And now I wouldn't trade it for anything. And to think all these angels are just clamoring to come down and become guardians to mortals on this planet, because it's such a strange, strange place. There are things that we can learn here we'll never experience any other planet as long as we live.
Very true.
And so as the older I get, the more I feel grateful. You know, I've come completely full circle on being angry at God for dumping me here to thank God you put me here.
Yes.
Where I can see these truths that I could have never known any other way. So.
Yeah. So well said.
How much longer do you have here before the first part ends here?
A minute.
It's about 10 o'clock now. 1 minute. Do you have something profound you'd like to say, Andre?
No, I just want to say.
No pressure.
We're not going to be streaming live. The live part will be cutting out shortly. And we will be, but you'll be able to hear the rest of the show on the podcast. If you and if Paula and Michelle want to continue talking, that's fine. I do need to scoot, unfortunately, but I definitely appreciate you being on, Michelle. I thank you for covering this topic, this local universe.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.
You know, as usual, we've been all over the place a little bit. I get some criticism from that from some people, but hey, that's okay.
That's life. That's life, Andre. What can you do
that's
about it? Hey, enjoy the conference.
That's talk radio. It's the spirit, and we just go with the flow here on the Cosmic Citizen. So I'm going to let you guys continue to chat if you want to chat, and I'm going to have to sign off here. But it's been a great pleasure, and I will see everybody again next week when we'll be talking with Halbert Katzen about Part 3. So thanks a lot.
Thank you, Andre.
Bye for now, Andre. So, Michelle, it's just you and me.
Do you have any other profound things you'd like to say, my dear?
No, there's so many. And I just want to say, Andre made a point that we're all over the map. Well, you know, that's probably true. And I've sat in study groups for since 1977 on a regular basis. And the one sentence from the Urantia book can open up a universe of thought, I have found. And so that's why, you know, you think about one thing, it kind of sparks something else, and there's just so darn much in that book. Every section, whether it's part one, part two, part three, or part four, you could spend a lifetime just studying one section and get so much out of it. And there's so much to say, and I know we barely even touched on part two, the local universe, our universe.
In 1 hour, how could you study the local universe in 1 hour? You know what, last year I did a study on the celestial ministry in the local universe. There's something like 56, how can I say it, 56 septillion angels, quadrillion angels working in the local universe, which is like a 56 with 18 zeros after it. Angels working only in the local universe, and that's only 1/100th of our super universe, which is only a seventh of all the seven super. This thing is so enormous, and for us to be able to get anything done in 1 hour discussing it, kind of a miraculous. But
well, and
really,
the bottom line for the answer is that it's trying to tell us, you know, we knew God was big, and we knew God was great, but we really didn't know how big, and how it really is trying to tell us that. It's giving us a handle on what does perfection mean, and what does ministry mean, and how great is God, and how, you know, there really is nowhere that we can go that he is not.
Exactly.
Or that his, you know, and it isn't, we're not abundantly protected and loved and nourished because he cares about us that much. And the Urantia book gives us that more than anything else I have ever found, is this sense of a cosmic purpose, hence the name of this show, Cosmic Citizen, the idea that we're not just humans on Earth. We don't just live and die, and whatever we experienced here was all for naught. We take all of those things that are of value, those experiences, those lessons learned, those relationships won, and we take those with us. Those are eternal. They have cosmic value, eternal value.
And you know what else they say, Paula? That for both the planet and the individual person, each planet is as lovingly administered as if it were the only inhabited planet in all of the universe of universes. And it's so interesting to me that it's also true that through the Infinite Spirit, he knows every living being. He knows every intelligent being in all of the universes. When you talk about how big, how great, how good, but you have a direct connection with God the Father. You have a direct connection with the Infinite Spirit, and we have a direct connection with God the Son. We, each of us individually, are as lovingly ministered to as if we were the only, we couldn't be more loved if we were the only person in the universe.
Michelle,
in fact,
we
probably would
caller.
Be less
shall
loved. Oh, good, sure.
425, you're on Cosmic Citizen.
Oh,
are you there?
Yes. Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I've been enjoying your program for the last since James Woodward was on, and I just, one of the things that I've learned from reading the Urantia book is that on one hand they've come to broaden our horizons as far as our understanding, our comprehension, the concepts. At the same time, they came and gave us the book in book form to alleviate confusion. They wanted to alleviate confusion. So many times when I see people like come up with the nicknames and all these things, sometimes it seems to perpetuate confusion. I was reading some words of, and I saw people nickname the universe Mother Spirit Nebadoni, and I thought, well, gosh, I wonder if that's a new cult. You know, so I am concerned.
And they're very specific. They do not give her a name. They do not give her a name. But people have often wondered why.
Right, and I've run across various people who have adopted lots of vocabulary from the Urantia book, mm-hmm. only to be taking advantage of people for you know, the same old stuff people take advantage of people for. So I think it's very important that we are very considerate in our use of the language, and try to preserve the meaning as to the highest meaning we can, mm-hmm. as we popularize, you know, the idea of that are coming from our study of the Urantia book.
So it's not to create more confusion. Is that's your point, isn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. I think it's intrinsically essential that we do our best to not perpetuate confusion.
But you know, and one thing that strikes me about the Urantia book is that it's such a gift in that it empowers the individual to explore these concepts in their own heart and mind, and to really just reach out into the universe and romance the universe as a child of God and say, you know, this universe is my mother, and I am alive within her cosmic womb, and I have the right to ask questions about her and about my Heavenly Father. And I have, and Jesus gave me permission to seek, ask, and knock. I have come to believe that the earmark of any great spiritual teaching is that it liberates you to feel free to play as a child of God and explore these concepts. And the beauty of the Urantia book is that there is no official interpretation, so that as we hold it up and we can say, oh, it's a truth that has saved and sanctified me, there's no doubt in my mind. But it's not crystallized. It's, in a sense, it's living. And you, what you get out of it is so beautiful. And what I get out of it is so beautiful, and there's nobody to tell me that is not the way to interpret that. I mean, they can say it, but the Urantia book gives me freedom to interpret it. There's no middleman, there's no clergyman or religion of authority that's dictating to any of us that we should believe this way or that way. We're free to find the Heavenly Father and these great universal realities in our own heart and mind.
And you know, Paula, that's one of the wonderful things about study group, too. Sometimes we'll share, and what you said, you've been in study groups for a long time, but we might only get through several paragraphs in 2 hours because we spend so much time talking about when we've interpreted it, how has it played out in our lives, that each of us might have a different take on it, and we find that so interesting. The other person took a different meaning from that sentence or that paragraph, and then we have a chance to talk it through and kind of get a sense of how interesting that in each of our lives and our life experiences that the same words can strike us in a different way and mold us and shape us differently according to what we had in our lives beforehand. So it's really interesting to making those words and bringing them into a personal revelation, something that you can use in your daily life to make progress and spiritual headway, so to speak. And sharing it with each other, how we interpret is one of those ways we can do it. There is no dogma. There is no priesthood. And so we're kind of each of us doing to the best of our own ability. You know, how does that strike
and
me through my own?
On our Father in our heart. And our mm-hmm. Holy Mother Spirit and the Spirit of Truth, and mm-hmm. all those things lead us towards perfection.
Yeah,
and but they do say that there is perfect, and you know we can all aspire towards perfect.
And you know what's interesting to me when we say the word perfect, and there's that phrase from the Bible, "Be you perfect, even as your Father in heaven is," and the Urantia book says to us that once we are standing on paradise, we will have one perfection, and that is perfection of purpose, that we have completely aligned ourselves with the will of God. We may not be perfect in any other aspect, but we will be perfect in our purpose, which is to serve the Father. You know, and that's interesting that we're so far removed from true reality that that's you know, in millennium of transferring through the universe, that's as we'll have that one perfection after all that time. So I look forward to the journey.
When we all come to that sense, I mean, one of the reasons I noted your program was that it's Cosmic Citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows that we're each citizens of a universe. I mean, people, it's amazing to think that our local universe were one of up to 10 million worlds.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Trillions of worlds.
But what does that mean then to us? It means that as we live in the context of our personal life, it is in our doing our Father's will, showing our Father's love towards each other. That's how our Father's love becomes known to others, as well as us assuring them that they, as you are pointing out, each individual can turn to their Father for consecration of their will,
mm-hmm.
so that
mm-hmm.
there is no two individuals that are the same. Everybody is got their own Father fragment that that gets to origin, history, and destiny. We can fulfill
mm-hmm.
our destiny.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I appreciate your letting me speak at this time, and
thanks
I will
for calling.
Continue. I had a terrible time logging in, by the way. But I'm really glad you went to 2 hours.
Well, thank you, and thank you for calling. You know, thank you for making a comment. I want to remind callers, you don't just have to call with a question. Please call with a comment or to share or to add or expound on anything we're discussing. We love that. That's why we're doing this. It's wonderful. I'm glad you called. Thank you.
I'll be a regular listener, and I've been sending the Blog Talk Radio web thing to as many people as I think would be interested.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for calling.
Can I stay on the line, or do I need to hang up?
Whichever you prefer.
Thank you.
So, Michelle, I think that, you know, if there's nothing else that we can touch upon on the local universe, there's just, I can't imagine there's nothing else because there's so much.
I have another appointment at 10:30, though.
That's right. So maybe it's best that we wrap up for now. And I thank you so much for being a part of the show. I love you dearly.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been a joy. So, yay. Look forward to next week.
Oh, thank you. You bet.
Okay.
Have a wonderful day, my dear.
You too. Goodbye now.
Goodbye. Thanks again, my friends, for listening to Cosmic Citizen. And we'll be back next week talking to Halbert Katzen. On part 3, the history of Urantia, which is essentially the history of our planet. Very insightful stuff, and I hope you'll join us. And until then, have a wonderful, blessed week, and bye for now.